I'd like to start this morning with a couple of discoveries that I've kind of, or observations that I've made about our culture. And these discoveries have helped me really understand the anxiety, but it's also helped me understand why, as a man, what makes me anxious, and why am I so affected, a Freudian slip, infected with anxiety. For those of you who don't know my past history, I've worked many years as a youth pastor, youth director, and I've been involved with young people for the last 15 plus years. And I've seen many, many, many young people, and I've watched their journeys. And as I've watched this and I've thought about my own life, it's dawned on me that our culture is very unclear about when a boy becomes a man. Have you ever thought about this? So when does this happen? When does a boy become a man? Now, I've asked some people to help me with this question. So men, for those of you who I've talked to before, could you please stand right now? All right, here we go. And at the count of three, well, I've asked them to read when they will become a man, or when what our culture may be saying about when a boy becomes a man. So on the count of three, I would like you to read your definition. Ready? One, two, three. Wow, that was so clear. Thank you. I think we can all go home now, can't we? Wait a minute. I heard a lot of, boy, I heard a confusing crowd. What I'd like to do is I would like to go individually, and I'd like to have you read when your definition, or maybe one of our culture's definition about when a boy becomes a man. Would you start, Dallas? Our culture can say that, can it? When I joined the military, you can sit down. When I can turn 21 and finally drink. Thank you. When you have a child. Ah, great. Thank you. A lot of definitions. So which one do you think? And for those of you who are mothers, what are you going to tell your boys? When are you going to look at them and say, "Son, you're going to be a man when you..." And the truth of the matter is, in our culture, we don't really know when that happens. And as confusing, as chaotic as it sounds, when everybody was saying their definition, really, that's what's happening in our culture all around us. This guy's living, this one's living this way, thinking, "I'm going to be a man when I'm this, and I'm that, and this." And so we are confused. And this confusion, what I believe this confusion is causing it, is that many young boys and young men are walking through their lives thinking, "Well, I don't know when I'm going to become a man, so I've got something to prove for it to happen." So they're trying to prove that I'm a man when I can do this thing, or when I accomplish this one thing. Other boys or young men walk through life passively because they're afraid maybe they're going to fail. Now, a bit of my experience with this: when I grew up in my home, I didn't grow up in a house that had a Christian faith, so it was kind of up to me to figure out these messages all on my own. And to tell you the truth, if you would have pinned me down when I was in high school saying, "Bruce, when are you going to become a man?" I couldn't even really give you a reason. I figured somehow it was just going to happen, and maybe one day I'd wake up and think, hey, I'm a man. So it would have happened. So my first observation is that we don't really know when a boy becomes a man. But another question I have for you, how does our culture define a successful man? How do you know if you are a man and you think, okay, all right, I'm a man, but how am I going to be a successful man? Any ideas on that one? Cadillac Escalade. How about a Mercedes-Benz commercial I remember hearing a few years ago, like that says, "You finally arrived," you know, in that soothing voice, you know, you finally got it. You've hit it, all right? That's another message, but yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's just very, very arbitrary. So not as an arbitrary about when it happens, but then we're just kind of wondering, or whether it happens at all, but how will we know when we finally arrived if we don't have the Cadillac Escalade? How are we going to know? Well, our culture defines success, and I'm not going out on a limb here, being overly dramatic, but a successful man in our culture is a powerful man, right? A lot of power, getting things done. A successful man is a wealthy man, right? If you got a lot of money, you must be doing something right, so you're successful. Or how about this? A successful man is an educated man. Oh, what kind of degree do you have? Oh, you didn't go to college, huh? Oh, sorry. Not that successful, huh? Or how about a successful man is a man who's got a stable job, got an IRA, got a retirement, got health insurance, successful. See, the trouble is, we are defining success for men by accomplishing something, by achieving something. And our accomplishments are going to be reflected in what kind of power we have in our society, or what kind of status we hold, what kind of position we've arrived to. And so what's the result of this? What's this result? What's this causing in our culture? What is this causing in men? Well, I believe it's creating a lot of anxiety, because for many of us men, we have developed some very unhealthy strategies of how to succeed as men. Or maybe we're developing unhealthy strategies to prove that we are men. Because again, if nobody has ever sat down with us and told us, I see you as a man. We can still be worried about it. Even if you're 50 years old, you can still be wondering about it. So what are these unhealthy things that we do? These unhealthy habits that men will do today. Well, many men will become a workaholic. And have you ever wondered why people are workaholics? Why we become a workaholic? It has to do with the F word. Not the F word that you think. The F word I'm talking about is a word that strikes deep pain into the heart of a man, and that F word is fear and failure. Two words, actually. Failure. How many times has our society said failure is not an option? And so we dedicate our lives to saying, I will not fail. I will do anything to succeed. So some of us become workaholics because we are afraid of failing, that we're going to work, because that's the last thing in the world I ever want to be seen as in this world, as a failure. Now others size up their situation and they're thinking the same thing. I don't want to be seen as a failure, so you know what? I don't want to even try, because what if I fail? So when you look at somebody who is what we would consider a classic underachiever, if you look at this person who's an underachiever in our society, you could look at them and say, ask, why is it that they don't want to try? And I believe it takes us back to the same core issue. We don't want to fail. We don't want to look like a failure. Aren't we winners? We're going to succeed. If I'm going to be a successful man, I have to succeed. And for women, there can be some similar things that you may experience with this as well. I'm not a woman, so I cannot speak 100% for you. And I don't presume to know a lot about women, although I know a little, and my wife has helped me with some of this, is that I heard somebody say that a man's greatest fear is to look powerless or to feel powerless. That's a man's greatest fear. And a woman's greatest fear is feeling invisible. Feeling invisible. And some of that feeling invisible, not feeling significant, some of that can be lived out by asking the question, does my life really matter? What is my life about? Or does my life have any meaning? So I know I'm primarily talking about men, but I also realize that women, you're wrestling with some of these same issues as well. What does it mean for me to be a successful woman? The truth of the matter is I believe that this drive to succeed can feel a lot like being on a treadmill. Most of you know what it's like being on a treadmill and gone on the treadmill, but just imagine for a moment if you're on the treadmill and you're doing your workout at 24 Fitness and somebody comes up and just cranks it up a little bit, now you're running a little faster, and somebody just keeps turning the dial up on you. And pretty soon, you are just going as fast as you can go, and the dial keeps getting turned up. Now, my family system, like I told you, my dad, I love my dad, but my dad had a horrible relationship with his dad, so he passed something on to me, and he didn't have much to give me emotionally and even as a dad to sit me down and to say, Bruce, you're a man now, and this is how to do it. My dad's spiritual advice for me was, God helps those who help themselves, and God help those that don't. That was the advice I was given growing up. And what I did with that advice is I learned that if I was going to succeed in my life, I was going to have to get busy, and it was up to me. And so my advice, or my dad's advice, it ended up putting a lot of pressure on me, because I realized that, you know, if God helps those that help themselves, well, then I better get to doing my part so I can keep God happy. That's anxiety, and that's stress that you carry with you all the time. And it worked for a pretty long time. Ran my own business for 17 or going to almost 18 years, a construction company business, pretty successful, and I kept it going, and I worked hard. I worked hard in that business, and I'm thankful. God blessed me. But in the back of my mind, I always wondered to myself, but what if my business fails? What if things don't work out? And so that becomes a stress. So we can be stressed if we're not working, or we can be stressed if we are working. Because if we've got a job, what if I lose it? If I don't have a job, what if I don't get one? The question that I want to talk about, again, I want to bring it up, but all these things that I've just discussed with you, are these goals and strategies centered on God? I mean, my dad used to say, God helps those who helps himself. Is that in the Bible? Well, sometimes we can make the Bible say what we want it to say, but this morning I'd like to share a passage of Scripture with you, and I'd like to talk about how Jesus talked about success and how Jesus wants us to think about success, because I believe the words of Jesus can bring life to our anxious souls, but it's going to be through a way that probably you don't expect. The passage of Scripture is taken out of Matthew chapter 16, and it's verses 24 through 26. So if any of you would like to follow along, you can turn to it. And let me give you a little bit of a background to what this passage is. Jesus is preparing his disciples for his death. And he's having a conversation with his disciples. And he sat them down, and he told them, the Son of Man is going to be arrested, he's going to be tortured, and he's going to be crucified. And on the third day, he's going to rise again. So he's explaining to his disciples, this is what's going to happen to me. Now let me ask you this. Does this sound like a victorious thing? Does this sound like something a winner would do? Does this sound like success? It sounds the opposite of success. And actually, one of Jesus' followers, Peter, his wheels are turning pretty much like my wheels would turn. And he's like, wait, you're gonna get arrested and you're gonna get tortured? Peter says, no way that's gonna happen. So he actually takes Jesus and pulls him aside and saying, this isn't gonna happen to you. I won't let this happen to you. And of course, in the classic response that we know of, Jesus looks at Peter and says, get behind me, Satan, for you're thinking of things of men, not of God. This is the way that life is gonna come. This is the way that I'm choosing, and this is the way it has to be. And Peter didn't get it. But after Jesus makes that rebuke to Peter, let's listen to his words. And after I read these words, I want to share some truths with you that I've come from this, that I've gathered from this. Then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their lives will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what shall it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? First truth I would like to talk about that I have drawn from this is that Jesus was a man that faced his fears. Now, if that may sound like a strange thing, when Jesus started his ministry, do you think that Jesus wanted people to follow him and believe in him? Do you think he did? Nod your head if you think so. Yes, thank you. I think he did. Right? He did. He wanted people to follow him. And he knew that his life and his message was going to bring life to the world. He knew that. But there was something that happened at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and we would call it the temptation. And when Jesus went out into the wilderness for 40 days, and he was tempted by who? The devil, right? He was tempted. Now, do you remember what these temptations were? There were three of them. One of the temptations that Jesus was given was that, why don't you, you know, you're hungry right now, aren't you, Jesus? This is Satan speaking, so to speak. Jesus, I know you're hungry. You haven't eaten for 40 days. Why don't you turn these stones into bread? Because maybe God's not going to take care of you. So why don't you just go ahead and you do it yourself? You turn it into bread. Jesus said, no, I won't. Second temptation came along where the devil came to Jesus and saying, you want to be a hit with the people, don't you? Don't you want people to follow you? Well, why don't you go up to the top of the temple and jump down, do this miracle, and everybody will follow you then. And of course, Jesus replies to that saying, no, I'm not going to do that. Again, I'm paraphrasing. Wouldn't that have been an easier way to get people to follow him if Jesus just decided, I'm going to do these tricks and these things? No, if I do these things, then people will follow me. There's no risk involved in that. And really, what the devil, the third temptation was, if you really want to be, to take your place as the Son of God, I can make this happen for you. I can make this happen for you. I can give you all of this, and you don't have to sweat it. You don't have to worry. You don't have to be concerned about if God is going to make all this happen through you. I'm going to do it all for you. I'm going to take the stress away from you. And Jesus finally said, now be gone, Satan. Do not tempt the Lord your God. And so Jesus was able to say, I'm going to walk through this, but I'm going to have to live with the tension of living my life with the hope that people are going to follow me, and that people are going to follow me. Well, since Jesus faced his fears, as a follower of Jesus, one of the things that he offers us is that he will take you to a place where you can face and overcome your fears, no matter what they are. Now, when it comes back to my question about young men today, we need some help here. We need some help, because facing our fears is something that our culture is not good at doing at all. And I would say that our society today, our modern society, I can't say this strong enough, we are virtually stuck here in a place that keeps boys and young men in a place of continual fear, because we don't teach them how to face it and to walk through it. Have you ever heard of a book a number of years ago, a book that was written called The Peter Pan Principle? Have you ever heard about that? Heard of this book before? Unfortunately, Michael Jackson would be a living example of a man who just did not want to grow up. Well, why don't we want to grow up? Well, because I think for many of us who may find ourselves in that position of not wanting to grow up, it's not that we're lazy. We're afraid. We're afraid of growing up. Now, this is a huge challenge for us in our modern society, and I want to point out a place where I feel like there's other cultures that are doing a way better job than our modern American cultures. And this would be the cultures of most indigenous peoples that have lived in our world. We've looked at many of these indigenous cultures and said, you're backwards, you're not advanced, you're not mechanized, and so therefore you're wrong. Well, my experience in studying indigenous cultures and even the Native American culture, I've discovered they did a heck of a lot better job at helping boys make a transition into manhood. And here's how they did it. The indigenous tribes were very clear. A tribe or a tribal community was very clear. Every time a boy was born, they would look at this little boy and they would say, who is this boy? And what place is this boy going to have in our community? And so family members, neighbors, all that were in the community came alongside this boy, and they knew that he someday was going to become a man, and they had a ceremony that would mark that, and it was a rite of passage ceremony. And many tribes have different forms of this, but there was definitely a ceremony that would happen when this boy made the transition into manhood. Now, what these ceremonies look like? Well, a young man would be, when the believing community would know that it was time for this boy to make this transition, the boy would be sent out on his own. and he would be sent out away from his parents, and he would be sent out into the wilderness to where he would have to be alone by himself in the wilderness. What do you think that boy is going to be feeling when he's out in the wilderness? He's going to have to, he is alone, and everything familiar to him is now gone, and it is just him alone. The intention of this event is that for a young boy to encounter God, to encounter God. And as this young boy would be out on his own, as he would face his fears and he would encounter God, when he would come back into his village or come back into his community, it changed him. And in a sense, he had faced the biggest challenge of his life. He had faced it, and he had come through it. And as he walked back into that village, he would be seen as, he would be seen differently by his community. Now, a boy became a man not by accomplishing something. A boy became a man by facing his fear. And this is the point, this is the part, as he came back in, now the process of maturing and growing would continue. Most tribes, the idea of mentoring older men, coming alongside younger boys, younger men now, still teaching them, growing them, the process of maturing still continued, but it did not start off of just major success. It actually came through a failure. This reflects more accurately the teaching of Jesus. If anybody wants to find their life, they're going to have to lose it. But if you lose your life, you'll find it. And this is where we're upside down in our communities, in our modern day communities. We're looking at young boys and we're saying, go accomplish something, and then maybe you'll be a man then after you accomplish this. But we're even unclear on this. So that's why I believe that if we can start to approach the way that we help boys walk through this process, it can help us to see that we aren't doing any our young men any favors by making them, setting up an environment where they can't fail. Because ultimately, when we experience failure, we realize that God is still there. God is still there. And that's why we are so tortured as a modern day people, because we're afraid of failing, because maybe some of us have never failed at anything. And because we've never failed, we don't know if God will ever catch us if we failed. Those of us who have failed at some things realize that God was still there. A second truth that I would like to talk about that goes back to this teaching on Jesus. Those who lose their life for my sake will find it. Well, what does it mean to find your life? Well, one of the things that I believe is that you find your life just as Jesus found his life by finding his fears, by confronting his fears, even by being tempted. When we surrender our lives to God, it opens a door for us to find our life. By confronting our fears, we can find our life. But what's this look like? Well, for many of us have grown up with an unhealthy label attached to us. We've grown up in a family system to where, in my family, I was the clown of my family since I was the last born. So I was the one who would do anything for a laugh. And so my place in the family was the comic relief guy. Tension in my family, don't worry, I'd just crack a joke or do something. And I was that. Now, I don't think that was all bad. But that's not all of who I am. That's who my family needed me to be. So that's who I became. I became that. But is that how God sees me? Am I just God's clown? Or am I the comic relief man for God? Is that who I am before God? Well, that may be part of who I am, but that's not really all of who I am. I'd like to shift a little bit and tell you a story, and it's in the Old Testament, and I think this could illustrate the point. Most of you are familiar with the story of Jacob and Esau, right? The patriarch and the story of Jacob and Esau. Remember the story when Rebekah was pregnant? She's having a tough pregnancy, even tougher than Shirlene's. She's having a tough pregnancy. And these two babies are just going at it inside of her. And she's thinking, man, if I don't even want to live, this is so bad. And so she sought the Lord. And the Lord prophetically told her, you have two nations living inside of you, two nations. And she eventually gives birth. And, of course, Esau comes out. And they named him Esau because Esau meant red, right? Esau meant red. So there you are. There's old Red, or young Red. And then Jacob, though, is delivered. But the funny story is that Jacob has got his hands on Esau's heel when he's born. And they named him Jacob or Jacob. And you know what the word Jacob means? It means supplanter, or kind of he'll trip you up, or he'll try to take what you have. That's the idea. Well, that's his name. He was named that in growing up in his family. And so, but not only was he named Jacob, he began to live true to his name, true to form. What did he do to Esau's birthright? You know the story. When Esau comes in, I'm starving. He said, well, you want a bowl of stew? You know, I'll give you the stew for your birthright. Fine, I'll take it. And so he took something from Esau. But not only it continued on, because Jacob's parents, we're told that Jacob's parents, a really unhealthy thing in their family is that they both these parents picked their favorites, right? Isaac loved Esau, and Rebekah, she loved Jacob. So all of a sudden you see these two kids growing up with the parents picking their favorites. And when it came time for the blessing, Rebekah, his mother, comes up with the idea, I got a way you can get that blessing. So do you think these wheels of success are already turning in her mind? They're thinking, I want my son to be a success. So she hatches the idea. Jacob takes her up on it, and of course, they pull off this amazing scheme, and they steal the blessing. They steal the blessing. Jacob flees, of course, because Esau says, I'm going to kill you if I ever, once dad dies, I'm going to kill you. And it's just terrible. So Jacob leaves home and then goes to live with his uncle Laban and kind of meets his match as far as another person who can is good at deceiving. But again, same patterns keep continuing. Jacob keeps trying to take and steal and trick and connive. Problem is it all catches up to him. Because as he's led out from Laban's and he's going back to his hometown to see his father, he knows he's going to have to face his brother. And when he faces his brother, he's scared to death. So all his living, all these unhealthy patterns, all these things he's been doing, they don't work anymore. He can't steal anything, and it has now come back to him. It's come back on him. As he is knowing that he's going to be facing Esau, he sends all his possessions out in front of him in waves. The first wave, all these camels and livestock, and then he's going to bring his family, and then he'll be the last one to meet his brother, hoping that when he finally meets his brother will be appeased by giving him all of this stuff. Well, Jacob then has a wrestling match with God the night before this meeting is supposed to happen. And they wrestle all night long. And if you read the story, it's a wonderful story, because in the end, the one he's wrestling with is God. And God says, let go of me, the sun's coming up. And do you remember what Jacob's response was? I won't let go until you, what? Till you bless me. That's pretty critical. Because Jacob had spent his whole life grabbing for himself, trying to succeed himself, doing it himself. I can do it. I can grab it. I can secure my best life. And in the end, he knew it's not working anymore. And he finally had to just relinquish his control, and he surrendered, and he allowed himself to say, I've just failed at this. I have failed at what I've been doing. And so he cries out to God saying, I want you to bless me because I can't bless myself. And God allows it. And then an amazing event happens. Jacob gets a new name. At the end of this wrestling match, God looks at Jacob and says, you know, you've been the Jacob, the conniver, the deceiver, the supplanter, the tripper-upper your whole life. That's really not who you are. You're Israel. And Israel, the beautiful name, is the one who strives with God. You're the one now, there's a new title of royalty and of blessing that's given to him. In the book of Revelation, Revelation 2:17, I want to read this to you because I would like to have us enter into a quiet time reflection, a little period of quiet reflection. Revelation says this, He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna. I will give him a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to him who receives it. The beautiful thing in this thing is that God has a new name for every one of us. And you know what that name is? That name is who you really are. And maybe you've lived your life. You probably have your own specialized coping mechanisms, as each one of us do. Some of us may be like Jacob, got to be the winner, always figuring out a way to win. Some of us maybe have done it with sheer power and force. Maybe some of us have, well, you fill in the blanks. That's not who you are. And if we are in position right now in our world where we're feeling the anxiety, we are feeling the stress of all of this life, instead of looking at all of this anxiety we're experiencing and saying, God, I wish you'd just take it all away. Instead, maybe we need to ask, God, what are you trying to show me through this? And maybe I'm in a place now where I need to surrender. And I need to allow you to take over. I need you to show me who I am. And I need you to show me even how to let go of my life and maybe to quit trying to save my own life. We've all been named something. And I believe our families or even our society, friends, or whoever, they've named us. And God wants to show us what that new name is of who we are. So can we just have just a few moments of reflection? And I'd just like you to think about this and just reflect on what we've spoken. And if God gives you a word maybe for our congregation, feel free to come up here and to share it. And after a few moments, I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up and to lead us.